Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
So, Guy, Nick Mason's Sourceful of Secrets, of which we are two-fifths, right? We're going back out on the road in the summer across the UK.
We are. It's all of June, so brace yourself.
What's it called?
It's called the Set the Control Tour. What a brilliant name. Who do you think could have come up with such a great name for a tour, Gary?
I wonder. I think I'm looking at him, right? But then I did come up with Nick Mason's Sourceful of Secrets.
You did, and in fact, that came up in a podcast then because you were inspired by Woody Woodman's U-Boat, weren't you?
I was, yes.
Anyway, but enough of that.
So, join Nick, Guy, Lee Harris, Don Beacon, and me as we celebrate the early years with, you know, that incredible, it's an incredible body of work, isn't it? The early Pink Floyd. It goes up to just before Dark Side of the Moon.
Goes up to 1972, with all the film soundtracks, all the Sid stuff you've never heard, stuff that no one's ever
heard,
frankly.
Obviously.
Echoes is the big sort of, you know, what is that? What would you call it?
Magnum opus.
Yeah, I love a Magnum, don't you?
Yeah, I never met Magnum. Anyway, tickets are on sale now and you can buy yours at myticket.co.uk.
And Kilimanjaro Live presents Nick Mason's Sourceful of Secrets, the Set the Control Tour.
Hi, Guy.
Hello, Gary. How are you?
I'm pretty excited. Andrew Lou Goldham.
This is a big one. I mean, as Andrew Lou Goldham, he kind of, you know, wrote the book. It's sort of him and
he did.
Brian Epstein and Kit Lambert and Chris Stamp. Those are the names, aren't they?
That's right. Peter Meaden, does he fit in there?
Not really, although Don Arden does, although in a very different way.
So basically, this is the birth of rock and roll. This is Mount Olympus, and rock and roll is being invented up there by these guys. And he's the youngest of all of them, isn't he? He's even younger than the Rolling Stones, who he's about to manage.
That's right, and he was, I mean, he was literally writing the book as he went on what you did.
You know, I always wonder with Andrew, because he went on, obviously, and started the immediate label with Small Faces and Jimmy Page, etc. But I always wonder with him, you know, did he see himself as being part of the band, or was he like, you know, was he learning from the old school of, you know, the managers that had gone before?
Yeah, he started that school of like I said, him and Kit Lambert and Chris Stamp, people who I was as enamored of people like that when I was a kid as I was of the bands, which is why when I first met you lot in Budapest, I was as excited about meeting Steve Dagger as I was about you lot. And in fact, it was him who became my mate.
It's true, because when we started at Spandau Ballet, but we weren't even called Spandau Ballet in 1977, and Dagger was managing us, you know, our heroes were all musicians. His heroes was Andrew Lou Goldham. That's who he aspired to be. This guy is full of stories. You know, I'm sure he is. You know, he started off as he worked for Mary Quant, and then he was a publicist for Dylan for a few weeks when Dylan was in the UK. He was the Beatles publicist for a bit when the very early days.
Yeah, and so the story of how that led to the Stones' first proper hit is extraordinary.
Extraordinary. But there's also a big story about how you met him.
It's so mental. I can't wait to get into it, and he'll probably sort of dispute the whole thing. Let's get him on.
Welcome to the Raconteurs.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
That's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I'm sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
Thank you guys for still being around, still making music, still being into it and doing this podcast. It's fabulous.
Well, I get the feeling that us three should go for a pint. That's what I think.
I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
Get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Raconteurs podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Keep on rocking!
Hello, I'm so glad you're here.
Hello, Andrew, we have met, and the story of how and where we met is so mental, I'm not even sure it really happened.
Can you do it in a paragraph?
I can't. Well, yes, it was, I had, in 1991, I arrived in Bogota from New Orleans, which is a whole other story, and I was staying with some friends, who I knew through Chucho Merchan in London.
Don't pronounce his name like he can.
Chucho Merchan. You're right. Sorry.
Yeah, please.
Well, you've got me worried. I'm rushing it. He's a fabulous musician and animal rights activist in Colombia. Anyway, so these people I'm staying with, they say, listen, our friend has a radio show. Why don't we go down there and hang out? And I'm pretty smashed and discombobulated.
Was it Willie?
I think that's right. Willie, yes.
Yeah.
And I go down there and then I'm thrown on air and the other guest is you. And you and I just stand, we're standing around a mic for hours, just getting wasted on air. Just having the sort of chat that people in that state do, getting to know each other on the radio. Right. Now, after which we repaired to your fabulous Bondian penthouse apartment.
That's where I am now, yes.
Is that where you are now?
Yes.
Which was just... And this is my first day in Bogota, and I'm just thinking, this place is fantastic. So there you go. Well,
that's how I felt 45 years ago, and it's still fantastic, without being on air.
So is Willie still around?
Oh, yeah. He's some of the people he was partners with kept doing the air and they're no longer with us. But he he is on the coast for the most part, you know, taking it easy. He's good.
Oh, brilliant. Well, send him my love.
I most certainly will.
Andrew, it's great to meet you. You know, we were talking before you came on how when in the 70s, when you know, I was 16, 17 and had a band. And one of the slightly older kids at school who said, can I manage you? You were his hero then. You know, my heroes were Bowie and whoever it might have been. But right. He wanted to aspire to this great sort of manager who had flair and charisma. And that was you.
Did he get to that place?
He did get to that place and he still looks after my publishing 40 years later, 50, 45
years
later.
Oh, well, that's good.
And yeah, but I guess we have to go back to you and what London was like before rock and roll, British rock and roll was invented. I know that
Can we stop halfway back there? And I mean, your Cray movie is still my favourite.
Ah! Thank you so much. Well, that's nice.
I don't know why I compare it to, but there's a sort of John Borman film with Marcello Mastroianni called Leo the Last. And for some reason, I sort of think that both were filmed in the same manners, you know, M-A-N-O-R. it was a delightful film. I mean, Legend was all cosmetics and Dusty Springfield, but your film nailed the little about that life that I knew.
Well, that's great of you to say, and I think a lot of it was Philip Ridley's script. Of course, I haven't seen Legend because I'm too bitter and twisted to ever watch it.
I felt that way about Performance. Because I knew that James Fox was doing me.
That's interesting because James Fox's part of that in Performance of the gangster was one of the things I went to research Ronnie. You know, that's an odd connection. We're only two steps away from each other here.
There you are.
Course, you'd left by then, hadn't you? You weren't part of the band by the time Performance was filmed.
Oh, no, Performance. No, I did have the squalor of Donald Camel coming into my office in around 65. And he was brought in by another nice junkie. And I really wasn't ready to ask the Stones to, I mean, here's in the concertina of time, you know, 3 or 4 years later they were doing it. But I didn't really like that underbelly, the idea of going into that underbelly, which Performance was, because come on mate, we've only had two number ones. Now you want us to turn and shit on it, you know.
Yeah.
He got his way you know, a few years later with that movie, and I'm glad I wasn't around for that.
It's interesting, isn't it, because you say that was 65 and yet the 60s that we see in Performance was only just kind of being born then, wasn't there? There wasn't really the sort of hippie bohemia, certainly with the Stones or anyone. Yeah.
I don't know. I think it kind of started at the end of 66 when the public started taking drugs. Because that made a huge difference.
Yeah.
If they could get them, though, outside of London.
That wasn't my problem.
You know, but I guess what that film touches on, is the merging of class that was going on in the 60s. That, you know, the middle class rock and roll kid was not that far away from the working class gangster. They were all in and out of each other's beds. You know, you had Bailey Stamp and Kane all calling themselves by their surnames, which is a very sort of upper class military thing to do.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Right. And rock and rollers all hung out with Toffs, didn't they? You know, that was.
Did that begin with you?
See, I mean, it changed for me in 66 when the Stones sort of got their first feeling tired and came back to England, and then a load of well-spoken velvet jackets descended on us, and life was never the same.
You, talking of velvet jackets, Chris, there's my little intro. You started in fashion, didn't you? And I just wondered what you wanted to be. You know, there was a, you know, when I think back of the times, as far as fashion and youth culture was concerned, you go back to the 50s and the Teddy Boys, and then, you know, maybe the Beatniks. But what was happening? What was a young man meant to look like in pre-rock and roll?
Well, it's more to it is, where could you get anything near the way you might want to look? I mean, okay, CNA still exists in England, right? Does it?
It does in Europe, but not in England.
Okay, but you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
Peter Meadon, who I hope you're both familiar
with. Yes, of course. He made the Who mods.
There you go. Right, he used to take me up to CNA's between, nearly by Marble Arch, and we'd go up and ferret around the fourth or fifth floor, and you would find amongst all the stuff, for some reason, American unlined sort of jazz... sort of Adi Shep, Ahmad Jamal type suits. And there might be 10 or 8 or 12 in the back, and you grabbed them because they were a good price, a price you could afford. And because the only other choice was a place next door to Cecil G's on Shaftesbury Avenue called Austin's, which catered for all jazz musicians and John Paul Jones. It was a question of where you could get it. And that's why places like... Well, the East End did better, I think. Vince's, we can't forget Vince's, because Vince's of Fubert's Place, because they gave Sean Connery his first job.
Right.
You know, he was a model. He was a male model.
Yeah, but, yeah, and, right.
And his briefs are 12 and 6, you know, like. So I don't know. It was somewhere between, Lawrence Harvey and... Stanley Baker.
John Stephen, did he change much up in Carnaby
Street? He was amazing, because I remember the day that my, there's two words I have difficulty with still, first wife, that you could, and with Chrissy Shrimpton, with Mick, we could all wear the same trousers. You know, he didn't have, there was no need to alter them. Mm-hmm. He just had an antenna that understood the geometry or whatever it is of the body, and he cut incredibly. I mean, to be able to go into a shop and go, well, you try them on, see if they work for you, and they did. It was amazing. And he was ambitious beyond John Reed, who came out of another similar area outside of Glasgow, right? I mean, both of them were relentless, you know. Yeah. And John Stephen at the time, I tried to get work from him, but he just wasn't having it.
It was Mary Quant that you went to, wasn't it?
I did.
What was happening there when you went? Because this is pre the Mary Quant that we know, isn't it? That sort of.
I don't think so. She already had the two stores, one in Knightsbridge called Bazaar, and the other one in King's Road, you know, on the corner of that square, opposite where Joseph Losey used to live. And so she was already going. I mean, you got to remember that even, say, when I worked for her, which would have been 62, these people, like her and her husband, Alexander, and Vidal Sassoon and Bailey, were already, had done the first British invasion in New York.
Right.
You know.
So they, in a way, they opened the doors for the Stones and bands like that.
I don't know. In there America. Was another guy called Nicky Haslam who...
We know Nicky.
He was there before everybody in New York.
He'll be really glad
I think he was the editor of a Huntington Hartford magazine. I can't remember the title, but it was like, you know, basically based in entertainment and life as it was going. So you had that incredible thing. I mean, Bailey was there already, man.
It's funny because it was Beyond the Fringe had taken New York by storm, hadn't they? Sorry, around this time, as opposed to rock and roll.
Yeah, I've got huge problem following, that or what came before. What came after? I mean,
Joseph. You mentioned Joseph Losley living on opposite Mary Quant in Kings Road. Was that in the house that he shot The Servant, the movie, the Dirk Bogart?
I believe it was. It was.
Which is another movie about the blurring of classes, isn't it?
Yeah, but I mean, you know, all of them generally come under the line of whether you're dealing with drugs or drink, or first you take them, then they take you, because by the time you get to the ingredients of performance. Whereas in 1965, had we invited Donald Campbell into our lives, we might have gone, this is really strange, isn't it, right? But by 1967 or 8, it wasn't strange. The concertina of time had bunged out quite a few chords rapidly.
But it seems like you always had that feeling, and I don't know if this was something about the burgeoning of the age, was that it seems because you just went and knocked on doors, right? You clearly already had this feeling there was nowhere you couldn't go. I don't know if that was something that was in the air, that everything was available to everyone and you could do that.
I don't know. I think every one of us thinks it was only happening to us. I know that recently I saw Terence Stamp and he said, I just thought I was the lucky one,
Right. You were part of an engine, I guess, of kids who didn't have to join the army anymore. You know, like my dad was conscripted.
That was Bill Wyman.
Yeah, so it was mine. That's right. Yeah.
You didn't need to be conscripted and you had that energy, and you were looking for a uniform.
Yes. That had a big play in it. You also got to remember that the stoic silence of our parents over what happened in World War II. I mean, we look at Ukraine now, and as it's so close to all of you folks there, and go, well, you got another 5 years to go, mate, in terms of what our parents. And I mean, they were silent, except for those, say, maybe like the fathers of Pete Townsend or, who had an outlet in that music. I mean, I was reading just the other day. Oh, I know what it was. Yes. Somebody sent me kindly an interview from a few years ago with Jeff Dexter.
Oh, yeah, yeah. DJ at Middle Earth.
Who, because we didn't have all this then, I never really had the time to meet when we were all busy, right? The interview was interesting because, I used to think of Cyril Stapleton and his orchestra, like, oh, God, right? But he was saying, in the time that they were playing in ballrooms, which were half disc jockey, then dance bands, and then little bands like Tony Crombie and things like that, he gave a lot of cred to Cyril Stapleton, whereas to me, he was just an old tosser with a batter, but all that thing that I, back then, if you didn't have a tough friend with you, you didn't walk. I'm talking about when I'm 12, 13 or 14. You didn't leave Northwest 3 unless you were covered because, fisticuffs, kick and run maybe. But if you went into another or when I used to go to where Peter Meadon lived in Islington or thereabouts, it was like a Stanley Kubrick movie, man,
But you knew Pete well. Did you, Pete Meadon?
He opened up Soho and a lot of other life for me. We did a copying basically Vince Fubert's Place. We did a brochure for John Michael and Sportique, which we traced all of the drawings out of Esquire magazine and then put John Michael's Clobber, and it was a story about a film director called Ted Wayne, who drives his Thunderbird from Elstree in London to the south of France, and he picks up this boy on the way, you know, and the boy is wearing gingham shorts that come in pink, blue, and mauve, 59 and 6, you know.
But how many boxes did that tick? Americana, you know, swinging London almost, and then and France, you know.
All that, yeah.
And picking up a boy, a bit of Death in Venice in there.
It's fantastic.
Yeah, there you go. But he didn't pay us because all of his homosexual clients were offended.
Would Pete have taken you to the Two Eyes Club maybe to see the Shadows?
No, I went there before I met him. Wasn't really his. I witnessed like Vince Taylor.
Yeah, yeah. Vince Taylor was a massive influence on Bowie. Ziggy Stardust was born out of Vince Taylor.
Yeah. Only once he started taking acid. I mean, Vince Taylor had. I saw Vince Taylor in the Two Eyes. I remember his Pledging My Love and Brand New Cadillac on Parlophone. Then the next time he was standing outside the Ad Lib Club, like, you know, not really in love with all the clients of the Ad Lib Club, be it the Beatles, the Stones, the Kinks, the Who, or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then the next time, then he was in France, and it was just amazing what happened to him there, considering he couldn't sing.
He lost his mind, didn't he?
Yeah.
Bowie saw him suddenly, I think, in Tottenham Court Road trying to decipher some strange map that he'd imagined.
Yeah. But there's always, you know, that. But the Sportique thing was great because then Peter Mead and I received a letter from an American manufacturer who had seen our brochure and was delighted with it. And would we meet him in Liège? And it was a come on, man. There was no one there. Right. And I just, you know, remember we had half a bottle of brandy between us, no overcoats, because generally at that time you don't need overcoats, even though it's cold. Right. I mean, well, with you two, what's the first age you got an overcoat?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Because, you know,
that's
kids.
That's a good point. Yeah, you're right.
My kids now, you're not going
well, when
out
I
like
did,
that.
It was a style thing. It was a 50s look.
That's funny.
Thing, rather
couldn't
than
fucking afford an overcoat anyway.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. Second hand.
But was there, I mean, I'm guessing that sort of Shadows rock and roll had kind of begun, and the Beatles had begun before you found the Stones, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I did publicity for the Beatles for 3 months between January of 63 and April of 63. So I did the tail end of Please, Please Me. And the beginning of From Me to You. I mean, I actually,
because their operation was still in Liverpool, right? So
that's
you
right.
were basically
that's the only reason I got the gig.
You were the London, you were the guy on the ground in London.
Yeah, and yeah. I used to have them every 10 days. They stay in that hotel in opposite the Royal Court Theatre in Sloane Square, and you know, when I look back at it, you know, as I attend occasionally some of those meetings in LA, and the first thing that came out of when I went to one out of Ringo Starr's mouth to me was, "Hello, Andrew, nice to see you without the horns."
Because in your first book there's a story of you going to Record Mirror and employing, like, it is like something out of performance. You're basically kind of hanging people out of windows, it seemed almost.
Oh no, that was yeah. But it's more theatre than the actuality, right? I mean, but the point about Ringo and George is even then, nobody was interested in them. And so the horns, whatever, you remember that people remember everything.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it wasn't.
Well, you certainly do.
You've got great recall. Yeah. But were the journalists still, were they from another generation? Were they sort of poo-pooing what was going on as light entertainment for kids and it's not going to last? Or there were no serious rock and roll journalists?
I mean, the first time that we did a photo session on the River Thames, just a few blocks or one block from where the Stones mostly lived, Edith Grove. I mean, you know, they all go, I mean, you've got this, you know, as we live in a, not this conversation, but as we live in a world where I doing a normal interview, you would ask me the question and supply the answer And I'd only be able to reply yes or no, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. You know, which is to see Michael Caine put up with that a few years ago. I said, what the fuck is he doing walking on the box? Like, you know, I mean, anyway, yeah. back end.
So, Michael, you loved making that film.
Yeah. Okay. But anyway, so we had some photographers on the banks of the Thames. And, the point I was making was this image now, these regurgitated interviews that so-called journalists put up on everything and so-and-so, Mick didn't like this, and John Lennon thought I Want to Be Your Man was a load of crap and all this. Like, the photographers there, I actually heard one say, God, they're dirty. And I knew that, oh, this is good. What would have happened? What would the Rolling Stones thought of me and themselves had I said in the beginning, I think you're really good, man. You can be the opposite to the Beatles. I mean, yeah. Come on.
Which is the legend that you, you apparently did.
Yeah, that's, you know, and this, and unfortunately or fortunately, the way it is because of how these things, if you're in it for the business, you do so many things on rote. I mean, the actual acts buy into that or let it go when, I mean, at the time, when we got the song, I Want to Be Your Man, if you study the reviews, if you look at the reviews of the time, there was no clash. There was no, oh God, the Rolling Stones have done a Beatles song. Nobody cared. It was just mm-hmm. matter of fact, like the wars in Kenya and Cyprus or whatever, three lines of, and that was it, right?
But just jump back a little bit, because, you know, where you met Brian Epstein, and because before then you also was a publicist for Dylan for a bit, weren't you?
Yeah, especially, you know, the man, especially what's happening to him this week, you know.
With a robo sign.
Yeah, right, you know. But nobody wished each other bad or ill will or schadenfreude at that time. I mean, I would have journalists who wore suits, the tobacco still dripped down on their shirts and things like that, who weren't threatened by the likes of me or the, you know, people, right? They I think they were bored with, you can't be bored with Al McCogan. I'd like to think of somebody else. Nobody was ever bored with Al McCogan. In fact, when I was in court over Media Records in the year 2000, the only one of my records that the fucking judge, he's dead now, like, was interested. He said, oh, he did Al McCogan, right? You know, I would have put fucking earrings in if I'd known, right? You know, I was trying to straighten up and look like Terrence Stamp in The Hit, but, you know, no such joy. But the velvet boxed Al McCogan collection, because they had to have all my records in the court, that excited him. The small faces, no.
Get back to Dylan, where you happened.
Yeah, because this lost TV show is extraordinary. I'm sure, and a lot of people, I think, just don't know about this.
Yeah, I mean,
his background, the director, appearance.
The director, Philip Saville, who I believe was embroiled in some scandals later on. He was at the BBC then I think he went to Granada. But he had been on his summer holidays in New York, and he'd been to a lot of the clubs in the village, and
Cafe Noir or whatever.
all of that, right? You know, the girls with the baskets. He was this big, but how did he sing? And he saw Bob Dylan. So when he was doing this house on Carroll Street, but what about the music? And he actually just said, well, I saw this guy in New York who was really good. Perhaps we could have him doing the background music. And, you know, I mean, it's a lovely overhead, you know, Dylan, a guitar and a manager. And so they came over and they appeared in this thing. I just went up and knocked on their hotel door. Like,
just to clarify for people, this is basically, this is a TV drama, and there's a scene in a club, and Bob Dylan, and Bob Dylan is the guy sitting in the background playing.
In the music.
It's nothing to do with him, yeah.
No, nothing to do with him, right? I don't even know what you're playing, man, you know. I think it was probably some kind guy like Jack Hutton or someone like that, or Max Jones, the Melody Maker, who told me, because that was the paper that carried all the Bob Dylan stuff, I mean, all the folk and the jazz stuff. I mean, Disc and NME, they could care less, right? But I think they were staying in the Cumberland Hotel. It's been billed as other places. But anyway, I remember, I mean, these days, now I think it might have been the whiff of marijuana that I walked into their hotel room, and it was magic. I mean, I was watching this conversation between these two people.
Albert Grossman, right?
Yeah, Albert Grossman. And I kind of knew what I wanted to do from that moment, because I'd been up till then, well, in the fashion, I just got out of it. I'd had people, I got out of it quite a lot, but I had a piddly pop period with nice people like Brian Hyland and Johnny Tillotson and people like that. And this was like war. You know, they were finishing each other's sentences. They had a camaraderie that, regardless of how Dylan attempts to repackage it now, was amazing. Because remember, music in England was still something that basically people wanted to sweep under the rug. It was not, you didn't admit you did it, if you know, in terms of record companies, and you never saw records.
But this was serious. And this was artistic.
It was all hustle, man.
Right. You know? And that's what you liked about it.
Yeah, I did. Yeah. It was a conspiracy. I mean, look at Dylan now. He's still hustling.
Yeah.
God bless him, because every time he does it, he changes the rules, whether it was Chronicles, or whether it was his classic interview on 60 Minutes with Ed Bradley, or
the Scorsese documentary recently, where they fictionalized
or his art.
So was Dylan like that character that we know from the Penny Baker documentary in 90, I think that was 65 when he came back to England, played the Palladium. He was still that. He was fully formed.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, this is his idol was Little Richard.
Wow.
You know, now that's not that strange. And if you think of when
we all thought it was Woody Guthrie.
Yeah, I think that's just usable fodder. You know, no. I mean, I was reading about his. He did so much homework on Little Richard. But if you look at it, the likes of Little Richard and Fats Domino, and especially those records out of New Orleans and then Specialty stuff, gave us the language that told our friends who we were, by who we liked and what we listened to, told our parents to stay out of it. And I mean, okay, Heartbreak Hotel. When that record first came out, I'd never stayed in a hotel and I'd never had a heartbreak. So that was like a magic, you know, a fusion of words. Like, I mean, I don't remember English people walking around like Elvis Presley's, I think, 1956 thing. I want you. I need you. I love you.
But doesn't Keith call that Keith calls that year one. He says everything's before is BC and everything after Heartbreak Hotel is AD.
There you go. Completely, completely correct. You know, I saw a clip of them on the Arthur Haynes show a little while ago, man. And Keith was moving. He was just so happy to be there, you know, because, you know, I mean, you know how the world was then. You were on probation with the record company. First of all, you'd be allowed a single, 45 RPM or thing. And then you'd be allowed another one. Then if you'd been really good boys, you could have an EP. I mean, Billy Fury, you know, he wasn't given a 12-inch album to start with. They only gave him a 10-inch album. You know, the ones that just had fours, like the high lows or whatever, right? So, you know, that's how we all got beaten up later over, how dare you ask for more money for cassettes or CDs?
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
This episode of Rock on Tours is sponsored by AG1, the daily nutrition supplement.
AG1 is a comprehensive and convenient blend of over 70 vitamins, minerals, and other vital ingredients like gut-friendly bacteria, antioxidants, and much more.
Just one scoop of AG1 daily has all the nutrients you need to support your mental performance, energy levels, heart health, and immune system.
To be honest, it's pretty vital stuff for us, because when you've got a life on the road and you're short of time, or you're too busy to plan and prepare healthy meals, you're getting your podcast together, you're being shouted at, and it's just a nightmare. AG1 gives me all the good stuff and helps keep my energy levels where I need, ready for showtime or doing the podcast, and with a nice vanilla taste.
It keeps me focused, feeling good, feeling healthy with its daily dose of vitamin C and zinc. And it's so easy to use. Just one scoop a day gives me over 70 carefully selected ingredients. Simple.
Trusted by Olympians, F1 drivers and the Rock on Tours. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and a free 1 year supply of vitamin D and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription.
Go to drinkag1.com/rockontours. That's drinkag1.com/rockontours. Check it out.
What was a key thing to you being the guy for the Stones was the fact that you weren't an R&B nerd.
No, I wasn't.
You weren't. Yeah. And so that you could see the big picture rather than saying, oh, that.
There wasn't a big picture. There was just things that had, the world before that was in black and white, then it did suddenly go into color, right? For Dave Clark, it didn't work. No, sorry.
Oh, the Tottenham sounder.
But hey, man, you know, as he knows, because we discussed it, when we first got to America and were basically like the Sex Pistols who could play, the Beatles looked over their shoulders. They didn't see us, man. They saw the Dave Clark Five and Herman's Hermits.
Yeah, yeah.
But when I say there wasn't a big picture, but all right, one of the, when you, Gary, when you were talking about the, you nearly mentioned the birth pill, right? And disposable income was just coming in because you didn't, you know, I think, okay, in the national service were all elements that there was disposable income, spending five and seven on a single was possible. I'm sure some, you know, with the amount of listeners that you have, some people don't even know what a record is.
That's true.
That's right.
I think we have a lot of good old school people on our.
No, I'm sure you do. But I mean, you know, like.
Well, I hope so, with all the names that are coming out.
Oh, yeah, it would help. But we were just avoiding the future, the non-future that we've been promised.
Right.
It didn't become a bigger picture until the Beatles appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show in February of 1964. Then it kind of got serious. The level of workshops and needed went up. But up until then, it was like, wow, we haven't had to get a regular job.
We have to go have to go into the Crawdaddy Club, don't we, though, before then, the year before, 63. How did you end up going in to see the Rolling Stones play there?
Oh, that was the Station Hotel. Was it
The Station Hotel, yeah, in Richmond, yeah.
So what was the Crawdaddy Club? Where was that?
I can't remember.
Was that not
Eel Pie?
There was the Crawdaddy, the Ricky Tick, which became the Moonlight Club. But most of it seemed to be West London, wasn't it? There was Eel Pie, there was the Richmond Hotel.
You wouldn't have got arrested, man. You know,
you saw them in the Station Hotel first of all.
I did, because a journalist at the Record Mirror, another man with the suit and, you know, fag ends and things like that, in the D-Hems pub on Shaftesbury Avenue. There was a young writer on the Record Mirror called Norman Jopling. The Record Mirror, we never knew at the time, man, about how wonderfully corrupt it all was. And we just thought, oh, this is good. You know, this is fine. But Decca Records owned half the Record Mirror, you know.
Ah, God, I never knew that.
No, I never knew that.
Well, they weren't telling anybody either, man.
That's our scoop for this one.
So I'm taking it the Record Mirror didn't write about the Beatles very much.
Probably less. I don't know how much, because the people who worked there, Peter Jones and Ian Dove and Norman, well, they ran it. I mean, they were journalists, you know, and there was... but you have a point. There were a lot of Decca ads in it, man, the Bachelors, right? You know, but Peter Jones... he was letting this young writer, Norman Jopling, write about this Rolling Stones band whom he had seen, even though the policy of the newspaper, or weekly paper, was only to write about those who had records, hence Record Mirror, right? Mm-hmm. And he went, Peter Jones said to me, you should go and see them. Now, that was a quandary for me. One, because of my, you know, I mean... my idea of R&B was Lieber and Stoller and Pomus and Schumann, right? You know, and the R&B thing basically ended up on Pi Records, who were like fourth in the line of you know, the pecking order, EMI, Decca, mm-hmm. Philips, and then Pi. And their records never went above 47 or 45. I mean, the stuff from Chess that they had on them. Yeah, right. You know, I mean, Joe Brown went to number 10, but that's, you know. But... and also, Sunday was Sunday night at the London Palladium.
Right.
And mother and she would iron my shirts and we would eat and watch Sunday, you know, and we would bond.
The Tiller Girls.
Yeah, all of that. The Tiller Girls. And then in the afternoon, Free Speech, Friend of the Craze.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. The Lover of Ronnie.
And then Liberace, which kind of changed the English lunchtime. You know, because mothers loved Liberace, you know. And so the idea of going schlepping from Northwest 3 to down to Richmond, I'd never been to fucking Richmond in my life, you know. And then my girlfriend, who would be my first wife, Sheila, she told me, no, because I thought, oh, I got to go from Finchley Road into Piccadilly Circus and then out again. And it was just looking horrendous. But no, there were overline trains from Hampstead on Finchley Road that would take me straight to Richmond. And the reason I had to go, I didn't know whether Peter Jones just wanted to get rid of me because I was hustling him in the pub, or he had good thoughts for my future and thought it might be, he hadn't seen the band, right? So I had to go, because otherwise, how could I go back to DeHems the following Tuesday and hustle him? So as I come out of the station, and I mean, I know you know this from the book, but I think I cross over and you're walking parallel with the train lines, and there's this sort of great, not barbed wire, but a fence. And there's a couple arguing on the towpath, and they are very attractive, both of them, because they look like each other. And it was Mick Jagger and Chrissy Shrimpton. And they stopped fighting. To let me by. And I had no idea till I got in, right, and saw the band, which, as you know, was six people at the time.
Right.
And, you know, I kind of had no rules. I mean, I didn't go, oh, Willie Dixon's version was better, or they did it, their version stood up to Howling Wolf. I didn't know any of this stuff, man, you know. So it was a complete tsunami of everything.
Had you ever seen anything like it before? Was it musically?
I'd never seen anything like it before. And I had no connection with any of the music. So that made it all the more pure for me. You know, they weren't going, there goes my baby, you know, right? And
so you're automatically the audience.
Very good. I remember that. Thank you.
And did you not? You must have thought, who's managing these guys? Because I want to manage them.
Yeah. And it kind of disrupted, you know, I mean, there's so many things that you do then on instinct, like, whereas now if we pick any given subject, what I thought about it in the 70s, 80s or 90s is totally different to now.
Yeah,
you know, I can give
it
to you hopefully in one sentence, you know. And you're right, I like that I was a member of the audience, which I want this. It's no you know, without knowing, I didn't go, oh, I can be Albert Grossman. But it was definitely that moment, you know, because what I was looking at was so different from everything, and I had no qualification about the music, so it was just a total pure I was converted.
Because George Joe Gromelski had some sort of arrangement, but he was away or something. Was it one of the
there is a line in Almost Famous where the character playing, I think, Lester Bangs, says to the one who's Cameron Crowe, says, "Don't trust these people." Sorry, Gary.
That's true.
You know, what a miracle you've had the same publisher. Like, okay. But because Giorgio Gomelski was being held on a sort of tether, "You're nearly our manager," by Brian Jones, who was, you know, I don't want to get into Bill Wyman territory because, you know, but I mean, Brian was the leader of the group.
Yeah, yeah.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. No. Which is really funny because we've never seen that. And it's because, you know.
Which is a good point as well.
Grown up with the.
Because later on, there's one of the big issues is that Brian's getting more money than the rest of the band, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Let's not go there right now. You know what I like about the idea that Giorgio Gomelski is gets ousted by you, really, because he's away on holiday in Switzerland, apparently.
Oh, no, he's not. Get the hankies out. He was burying his father.
Oh, dear. Okay. Because I was just thinking, it reminded me of the of Saudi Arabia or something, actually Qatar. Right? Now, when apparently two of their leaders, both of them, were taken over by coups when they'd gone on holiday.
That's right, when they'd gone on holiday
to Switzerland. But anyway, that story's not true. So
he was arranging the funeral of his father. Yeah, you know? But I think that, you know, Giorgio could get excited about a room with three people. And the Rolling Stones obviously wanted more than that, right? So sometimes when something important happens, you know, a moment, it's so overpowering that you blank it out. You do it and you do it well. But I'm believed that at another gig, not at the Station Hotel, at the one you mentioned, the... probably Eel Pie Island, that Brian introduced me to Giorgio Gomelski as his brother.
Oh, wow. Is that like he's my brother man kind of thing?
Yeah, he's my... No, it's not Neil Diamond here. No, it's, you know, so he didn't know what was going on.
Had he briefed you? Was that like, sorry, I'll say you're my brother?
No.
Yeah.
Briefed him.
No,
and I found out that through Giorgio, they already had a quasi-contract with IBC Studios. Yeah, because the band's not going to tell you, you know, when you're intro, like, you know, we'd like to manage you. I mean, by then I was bringing in the guy who was my landlord in Regent Street, an agent called Eric Easton.
Because you were too young to get a manager's license, is that right? You were too young to get a manager's license, whatever that was.
I mean, the other thing is you've got to get an act work. I had no idea how to do that. Have you heard of a lovely villain called Roy Tempest? Then I won't tell you.
No, but he sounds like a Larry Parnes stable singer.
Oh, yeah, doesn't he? Yeah, right.
Yeah.
But I mean, I went back to England on a scam, like in the early 90s. And these guys from Sweden wanted, it was quite interesting, it was around the time just before one of those wars that George Bush probably started, right? And the idea was to have a music festival that like FIFA, right? And it was going to take place all over the world and so it was all going to come eventually end up somewhere for the finals of these groups. And they wanted me to invest, but I got them to invest in me because I turn up with 9 pieces of luggage with the fax machine that wouldn't work in England and all this stuff. And we rent this apartment. I said to the guy who was getting stuff from me, either get me a really nice apartment or something beautifully horrendous. And it belonged to the ambassador from Ghana, right? And it was renting it out. And I have to go and sign the papers to, and this is worth it, to get the apartment. And while I'm standing there off the Marylebone High Street, you know, signing the thing, I see this little man down the end of the corridor sticking his head out. And I look at him and he comes up to me, says, "I don't know whether I should introduce myself to you." He says, it's that name on the real estate agent isn't really me. I'm Roy Tempest. But I didn't know whether to say hello to you because I didn't know whether I fucked you or not in the 60s. Like, I thought that was great. Right?
Yeah, metaphorically, you mean? Like, financially?
Yes. No, yeah, financially. But meaning me and the Stones, like, you know, on some pier.
It was the 60s.
Yeah, right. but
what do you think sold, how did you sell yourself to the Rolling Stones? What were you offering that no one else could?
You don't add yourself up at that age. You know, I mean, now, okay, obviously not to you, because when you, Gary, were young and the same age as me coming into it, you were going into a different thing where things had changed. You had to be good at the bullshit too yourself. You know, you weren't, I mean, the Rolling Stones didn't really have to say anything for the first couple of years. You know, they mastered what, let's leave the Beatles out of it, because they're a law unto themselves. You know, it's them and everybody else. But what places the Rolling Stones in a thing where they get, where it became people comparing, oh, the Beatles versus the Stones, and placed the Beatles above, whether it's the Kinks, the Who, or whatever that was coming in, or even the Zombies. But we like Colin Blunston.
We do. We had him on the show.
He used to share an apartment with an act I really liked on Immediate called Duncan Brown. He was great, Colin Blunston. Does a great version of the Jimmy Ruffin thing, right?
We love him. Great voice.
What Becomes of the Broken Heart.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, the other one, I'm sorry, you know, telling a club in New York, you know, how many BMI players he's had. I mean, apparently interest. Hold your head up. 5 million BMI players I had on this. Anyway.
Okay.
But anyway, I sidetracked.
Because now, in the fullness of time, it seems really obvious that it should have been the Rolling Stones. When you met them, they're the Rolling Stones, right?
Yes. Yeah.
With no G. And it's, but why, what was it? There's clearly something you knew or figured. But like you said, you've got no blueprint to work with. That is like, we need to make them the Rolling Stones.
Because you
why?
Don't. I can't remember the word. It's not marginalized. It's not, or make a diminutive. Mm. Or, you know, you're the Rolling Stones. Not the role. I mean, I can't remember. It's probably in one of the books, but it sounded good at the time. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. No. And now it seems completely obvious. But I'm just worried at the time to have that. You know.
Yeah. No. I get.
But, you know. I mean, see.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't. I've never been, quote, successful, the way that I was. I mean, Keith put it very nicely in his book, where he said something to the effect of, "We all got on with Andrew while we all liked the same music." That period where I said, where the public started taking drugs and you've got John Peel coming in, Alan Freeman suddenly has 3 hour shows as opposed to pop pickers, you know. And the album became the selling point. And also when we went from 4-track to 8-track, in that you really couldn't make mistakes. I read a great interview, which a friend of mine in California, Harvey Kubernick, put together, three interviews he'd done with Brian Wilson over the early 2000s, where he is so fucking lucid about the difference between tracks and this, so-and-so. The point is, 4-track to 8-track, 8-track, suddenly you can make mistakes. So I didn't wonder at the time, I just went, oh God, this is complicated. Like, because I come from the era of what you hear is what you get. 4-tracks was too complicated for me.
So you're beginning as a producer. You're going to be the producer of the Rolling Stones, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Not.
But you were saying back then, when they first went into the studio, this was the days of recording when you said the band weren't even allowed to listen back themselves.
That's
to
right.
What they'd done.
That's right. Well,
it's extraordinary.
Everywhere, in all the most of the, definitely the record company studios, there was this intimidating staircase that took you up to the control room. And being allowed up there.
Abbey Road's the famous one, yeah.
Right, and the white coats and all that.
But I guess what you're trying to find as a producer, Andrew, is you were trying to find two things, really. To try and capture the band the way you saw them live. So when people hear the record, they think they've got the same impression of you sitting in the Railway Tavern. But also to find the tracks, because they weren't songwriters, were they?
No, they weren't. And to actually have them try and be as loose, or when it worked on stage, I knew. I mean, you've got to, let's separate my fascination with Phil Spector and Bob Crewe to the job at hand with the Rolling Stones and all the producers I'd met would just add intimidation to the scenario, you know, and would tighten and stiffen the Rolling Stones up. And so therefore, I mean, I also knew about tape lease deals, but okay, there came a moment, we cut the first single, Come On, right? The engineer, Roger Savage, said to me, I said, right, you know, because we had 40 quid, it was 5 minutes to six, we finished at six. So he said, well, what about mixing it? I didn't know what he was talking about, right? So I said, well, what's that? And he kind of explained it to me. And so I'm looking at the clock and I'm going, well, you do it. I'll come back and collect you tomorrow, figuring that if he did it, I wouldn't have to pay for it. We wouldn't go over 6 o'clock, right? Now, after that, I went to Regent Sound and the wonderful Bill Farley, an engineer. You know, Regent Sound was mainly a demo studio. They didn't, they didn't cut many actual masters there, you know, I mean, and Bill was perfect. He's pure East End, and nothing about the Rolling Stones irritated him. He just went, okay, you know, he knew what he was listening to. He was good, as opposed to some of the other engineers there, or other engineers, and saying, my God, they're dirty, or whatever. All this music was not, you know, it wasn't Brian Paul and the Tremolos. But and so what we heard in Regent Sound, I knew was the finished record. I didn't have to putz around with four channels. And to say that all the run in Los Angeles and the run on three tracks in Chicago, it was a womb full of noise. So I became a producer because I figured they might behave like they are in front of me, whereas the chances are they may not or will not in front of a producer.
Let's talk about how you get that second single, because it was written by the Beatles.
I Want to Be a Man.
Yeah.
Well, they're rehearsing in Ken Collier's. And I kind of think that if your energy quota is not contributing to what's meant to be going on in the room, leave. You know, go to the bathroom, go out, you know, because it was a terrible, I mean, or a non-productive looking for songs. I had suggested James Ray's If You Gotta Make a Fool of Somebody, right? Great record, right? And then somebody said, no, actually, Freddie and the Dreamers have got it coming out in 2 weeks' time. And they were still not writing, obviously. And I thought, oh, my God. You know, these golden R&B numbers, you know, soon the only people who are going to be able to record them are the Searchers. But Chris Curtis had good ears, you know? The drummer, really good ears. And I go out and I turn right and I walk down to Leicester Square Tube Station, and getting out of a cab there, nicely inebriated because they had just received their first Ivor Novello gong or, you know, award, was John and Paul. And they knew me well enough. And so I was still Andy. And it was, what's wrong, Andy? And I said, you know, I'm down there with the Stones and we've got nothing to record. Now, if you want to meet hustlers, you meet John and Paul. Okay, like, because they had a song for everybody, and I know you'll understand, and I know that in terms of the things that kept you moving and kept the game going, for John and Paul to see three different versions of Misery, Kenny Lynch, Helen Shapiro, and their own, that on a label, that kept life going. It wasn't yet about how much of this company do I own?
But there's also, that's the old Tin Pan Alley thing, wasn't it? Whereas your success was how many people did your song, not how big a hit.
Yeah,
so that kind of feeding into that.
Dylan started that as well, didn't he? I mean, was it Tambourine Man or Blowing in the Wind, whatever, you know.
That, because, and Peter, Paul and Mary doing Don't Think Twice, It's All Right, whatever, right? I mean, there's the great thing. Albert Grossman managed Peter, Paul, and Mary, right? And he actually put them together. You know, they weren't singing. He went, that's what he knew what he could have and what he could do. So he was more than a one-trick pony. You're quite right. I haven't thought about it. Like, because in the Mark Winter, who was like an early client of mine in the PR, Venus in Blue Jeans and stuff, Go Away, Little Girl, he could earn more on the road if it was his face as opposed to another cover version on the sheet music.
Mm-hmm.
you know, it might be 20 quid more a week or whatever. And that's, you know, how it worked. You know.
There was no competition. The Stones weren't thinking, well, you know, the Beatles are our main competition. We're the opposite to them. We don't want their track.
Because bands didn't write songs. So, you know, before, so it wasn't really an issue.
So did they
it?
Literally go from that taxi and go, we'll come to the studio with you? Or did, was that the day after or what?
Yeah, they came, they said, all right. I don't know.
I mean, if you wrote that for a film, it would be too cheesy and unbelievable. Yeah. It would just be, too, do you know what I mean? It's like, that's where life is just beyond Hollywood. Yeah, yes, let's go to the studio right now.
Yeah. No, it's not quite that. Let's go to the rehearsal room. And we'll
rehearsal room.
You know, we were in the Ken Collier jazz basement, you know, trying to pull it together. And they came down. I died and went to heaven, man. The first time, you know, when they started to play it, we didn't know, and they didn't tell us, that Ringo Starr had already recorded it 10 days before. Right? Because, that, you know, I mean, I use hustle in the great sense that you're proud of your chops and your goods and you want, you know, fishes and loaves, man, you know. The moment you heard Brian playing the bottleneck on it, I went, oh, God, you know, I mean, you could hear it, you know. Yeah. And I kind of basically had my first nervous breakdown. And I went to Paris and bought a pair of 46-pound Pierre Cardin boots. I mean, you know, you couldn't wear them outdoors. You know, they were riding boots for indoors.
How did you know they were there? You'd seen them in a magazine, right? Or something.
No.
The boots.
No, I just had to get out of
it. Imagined.
I mean, I had to get out of Ken Collier's Leicester Square, Soho, London. I was just so overcome by the possibility of, because, okay, you're quite right, which when you said there was no competition, there was no that, but there were no second chances. You were given a recording contract.
Right.
And if the first single didn't at least get to 38 or 40, you weren't going to be given the chance to do another one. Now, we had bought a lot of the first, the first record, because it wasn't very good. In fact, when I mixed it for, because they were stiff, you know, understandably.
When you say you bought, you mean you it was like not payola, but
yeah.
No, it's the chart shops, right? You go to the chart shops.
Yeah, the chart shops. Yeah. But the Rolling Stones fans, the people were already wonderful, and they wouldn't even let me send them the 5 and 7 shillings postal order, which I didn't have.
But did they think this was a bit? Wouldn't they have thought, oh, the Beatles writing the Rolling Stones single? This isn't Muddy Waters, man. You know, are they? Were you in risk of losing the bass?
No, not at all. I refer to these. The reviews, they would just go written by Lennon and McCartney with no comment.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Because this rivalry that you called legendary did not exist. You know, there was no shout.
No, but I know what you mean. But we were talking about an audience. These are the people who kind of 2 years later are going to be calling Dylan Judas for going electric. It's just that level of purity.
Yeah, exactly. I was kind of prepared for a little backlash from some clever fucker, right? You know, going, oh, you know, like, but it wasn't on. That wasn't the game. I mean, this was like, life was opening up, and even with the, wasn't called the media, but no one was going to get in the way of this new life. Except the prick in the record mirror. Richard Williams was his name. Richard Green. I'm sorry. There is a Richard Williams. It's not you.
Yeah, no, he's too young to be that person, I would have thought.
There you go. But he had talked about Keith's skin. So
people are still talking about Keith's skin.
No, Keith's skin is beautiful.
Yeah.
It's certainly hard wearing.
Otherwise, I'll start on my...
Sorry, you were digressing, and maybe we should pull you back in. Because how you get these boys to eventually be songwriters, the songwriters that we are. What's interesting is obviously it ends up as Jagger and Richards, but it was Brian's band. Wasn't Brian ever thinking, I should be the songwriter here?
Or did you
let me finish with the John and Paul thing, right? I, for just pre-COVID, I did a course in a university in British Columbia. How was Nick Mason, by the way?
Fabulous. We've both been working with him. He's fantastic. Yeah, we absolutely love Nick. Yeah.
Fantastic.
Had a great tour.
Yeah, no, I went to school with him.
Did you? I didn't know that.
What? What? No. Why don't we know this?
Well, because
you're exactly the same age. Of course you are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There was a Kramer.
Nick, for 35 years, this has never come up.
Well, goes to show.
Like, very quiet.
Well, when I tell you what kind of school it was, it was a Kramer, right? When you're 12 or 13, and instead of having a summer holiday, we went to this place in Lyndhurst Gardens off Haverstock Hill, where they cram it into you. And I may be hallucinating, but I do remember visiting Nick's house once because he lived down the other side of Spaniards Inn going towards Golders Green, right? Whatever road is. Yeah. The amazing thing about Nick Mason is he already had a drum kit. Now we can go to, in a room, right. I'm sure, in this house with beams.
And he's 12.
He had a drum kit, right?
Yeah.
Wow. He would've done. That's posh.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's great, you know.
Fantastic.
I love the connection.
Right, Brian Jones. Okay. Here's the thing where life gets much simpler and goes on as long as it has, you know. When you can't sit there and go, I did this and I did that, it's really down to the fact that I was living with Mick and Keith. So had I been living with Brian Jones, you know, but my mother had sort of kicked me out, and so I was rooming in their place in Willesden.
Edith Grove?
No.
No. It was up in Willesden at this point, wasn't it?
Ellsworthy Road. After Freddie and the Dreamers, doing this wonderful James Ray song, If You're Gonna Make a Fool of Somebody. I mean, as I said, the songs were gonna go. And so, I mean, it's as simple as, I didn't say this to him, but I mean, if Mick can write postcards back to his mother or Christy Shrimpton, and if Keith can play three chords, then they can write songs.
That's right.
Then if anybody can write a first book or a first song or have a first hit record, but can they, like Sergeant Barry Sadler, can they repeat it? Right.
So you locked them in. You know, history is that you locked them in a room virtually.
Sort of. That's like opening the concertina up to.
Right.
I did. Fortunately, I believe the stairs were carpeted, so I could tiptoe down after I left because I would take my laundry back to the same Sunday night of the London Palladium mother who would iron it. You know, and I tipped back up to see if they were writing. And they hadn't turned on the radio. I mean, there was these silence and there was talking. So I've kind of figured they are going to get on with it, right? And Brian Jones later, I mean, I can remember the first songs. The worrisome thing is that when I say the first songs were naff, how come I remember them? You know, like, but Brian, I put together because I tried to keep this. I mean, I didn't regard it as a split. I just thought, I didn't go, oh, I better humor Brian or that. I just thought, hey, you know, I might as well try and do the same for him as what was happening with Mick and Keith. And so I put him in a hotel room with Gene Pitney, who was no slouch at writing songs, right? You know. And I can remember that awful, what came out of it, right? But Brian was this split, it was this strange split personality. I mean, it's amazing. He's having this on social media. The more it goes on, the more that little core people of you all betrayed Brian, you know, manifests and eats at the seeds of now that the Rolling Stones have become sort of like the Rat Pack, you know what I mean? You know, you know, there's envy from the purists. Right. Regardless of that, it was his band. He did sign the first contract. He did sign them with Georgia Gomelski and IBC, and Glyn Johns was there. And I remember rehearsing Brian saying, look, you want to leave the Stones because they're terrible. The Yardbirds is another group playing that R&B circuit, and you've had an offer to go with the Yardbirds. So could these kind gentlemen at IBC, George Clouston and Eric Robinson, the band leader, please let you out of your contract. Here's 90 quid. That worked. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been able to go to Decca and sell them to Decca.
Right.
I hope that story makes sense. It was really. Wow. I will always remember being in Portland Place. Now, Brian, you don't mention the Yardbirds, but have them in your mind. So I was living the sweet smell of success. It was good.
You mentioned Gene Pitney, because I know that, when you do your next record, Not Fade Away, which is actually my introduction to the Rolling Stones, because I remember as a kid hearing that record. I said to my dad, I like the Rolling Stones more than the Beatles. And he went, no, you can't like them. They're ugly and scruffy. And he was quite upset that my dad found it, like, it was almost sort of morally I'd made the wrong choice. But anyway, Not Fade Away, you mentioned Gene Pitney. You did that in America, didn't you? And didn't Gene Pitney play on the record?
That was done in Regent Sound in Denmark Street.
So what is it, Little by Little, on the B side? Am I wrong to think that Phil Spector's on that record and Gene Pitney?
Yes, he is on that record. And he eventually got a co-writer, named because Alan Klein was representing him and the Rolling Stones. Before it was Nanka Felge. But Gene Pitney was a client of mine too. And he came by, and I called him, and I said, we're in trouble, because it was not happening, right? Peter Meadon was there. So was Graham Nash.
So Graham Nash sang on the record?
No, they were like...
hanging out?
Getting, you know, making it, giving an atmosphere, almost like Joey D and the Starlighters, like...
because he was in the Hollies, you know, right there at that point.
Because
Because
I'd heard Keith play it in the rooms that we shared. And I heard a single, man, right? And so I mean, even in the level of my enthusiasm, I said, or I vibed that it feels like you wrote it, that Buddy Holly didn't write it.
Yeah. Because he actually did, yeah.
So Phil Spector came in, he played Maracas, right? And then he went out on the ground floor on the staircase going up to whatever it was, right? And he chopped out this 12-bar blues Little by Little with Mick. Then they came in and we had a B-side and that was it, right? And that was the first one that we didn't really have to buy. That went to number four or five.
Weren't you intimidated as a producer to have Phil Spector in the room?
Yes. Yes.
Because, this is all very early on, right?
No, you've got this Al Pacino, Lana Clarkson tragic history of Phil Spector now. And at that time, in February of 1964, Phil Spector was a total delight to be around. He was made famous in America by that book Tom Wolfe wrote, The Candy Colored, whatever it is, right? My theory or my belief is that Phil Spector decided who he was going to be based on that Tom Wolfe article, because the lifestyle was totally alien to Tom Wolfe and New York, where the first time that, say, Jerry Lee Lewis with the cousin he married, that didn't even make the papers in America.
Yeah.
Hang on, it's the candy. It was the candy-colored tangerine flake streamline baby.
There you go. Right?
The article.
And that chapter where two... get in a national newspaper in America, you had to be Sid Vicious in the Chelsea Hotel. It wasn't Jerry Lee Lewis in the car. Who the fuck is Jerry Lee Lewis, right? Jerry Lee Lewis changed our lives, you know.
So you're saying Phil Spector, as we know him, had not been created?
It was brewing. But
to you guys, he was a god, wasn't he? I mean, he was like, you know, this idea, the idea of the Uber producer only existed with him, didn't it? There wasn't anyone else.
Yeah, it was that element, but also the records.
Yeah.
I mean, but I have to give equal nod who influenced my life to the guy who produced The Four Seasons and wrote with Bob Gordy, or Bob Crewe. Because Bob Crewe was actually more generous and unafraid with his time. He didn't want to keep it a secret as to how he was making these incredible records, right? But Keith and I spent a lot of time with Bob Crewe, less time than we did with Phil Spector, because by the time he got to 65, you know, there's a change in who Phil Spector is. And but the one that was at England was a delight.
Andrew, would you mind if we got you back for a part two?
Because we've got so much to do and we're loving this, but you mean England and Wales?
Well, England and Wales are starting.
Because I feel like, well, partly that, and partly because I feel that there's still so much to, that I'd love to cover, and we'd love to talk to you about Immediate and the Small Faces and Humble Pie.
I'd like to talk about Mike Pratt.
Oh.
Well, I didn't really know him, but Lionel Bart was the next best thing.
Okay, can I quickly ask you this? Did you once blow up your house putting in a stereo and have to move into the Mayfair Hotel?
No.
Because I have a memory of being taken to the Mayfair Hotel and ordering room service when I was about 4 or 5 years old. And my mum says, we've gone to see you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But apparently I met you then at the age of about 4 or 5.
That's interesting. We're ending this.
And I also have someone we haven't got to at all yet, which is why we need part two. I've actually got a text from her wishing you all the very best, which is from Marianne Faithful.
Oh, how nice. That's great.
Whom you discovered. We'll get to that.
Who you discovered.
It's very have to do it's, part it's two. It's very apt, Guy, that we end how you actually met Andrew when we started with how you really met Andrew.
Good.
Andrew, it's absolutely fantastic listening to you.
I thank you both.
And we'll arrange really with our producer.
England is as good as we have been today.
We're going to arrange our producer to get in touch with you, and we'll get you back in a couple of weeks or something.
Perfect.
Or a week or so.
Take care. Brilliant.
Thank you, sir.
It's been an absolute joy, Andrew. Thank you so much.
All the best.
Mate.
Take care.
I think we did the right thing to decide to make this a part two.
I think there's just so much, because I've got to say his recall and his ability for tangent is absolutely gobsmacking.
And we all know that when you look down to see your podcast and it says 2 hours or something, it's quite intimidating. Yeah. So, I think there's so much left with him. I mean, so much.
There's so much left to do. But what's so nice is that all the sidebar stuff is so great.
This is, you know, isn't this guy's going to be, he's 79, 80, you know, they're all reaching that age. I often think when I listen to people of that age talking about pop music, it reminds me of when I was in the 70s watching old soldiers on World at War, you know, talking about such a bygone era. And, you know, now they're all gone. Yeah. You know, this is all about, you know, getting those.
It's true. It's like the Richmond Hotel, which I've kind of heard, you know, I've done more history research in my life. The Richmond Hotel as more than 1066 or whatever. And the Richmond Hotel has become like the football match on the Western Front on Christmas Day, isn't it? As a sort of absolute marker.
I think George Ogumelski was there too. Didn't he manage one of those sides? Anyway, listen, thank you for listening. We will get Andrew Lou Golden back very, very soon. And you can listen to the rest of his story because it is absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, it is amazing. And I'm assuming that you're all going to be as entranced as we have been. So
yes. And until then, thank you to our producers. We had Ian today, didn't we?
And we did have Ian. And thank you Ian,
because Ben is not very well. But thank you to Gimme Sugar, and it's good night from me,
and it's good night from them.
Step onto the legendary clay courts of Roland Garros, where the world's best players battle it out at the French Open for a chance to win a Grand Slam title. Tennis Channel Plus is your place to watch. Stream every court from your phone or smart TV live in HD. See the action unfold as legends fight for glory and new rivalries emerge. Daily live coverage begins Monday, May 20th, with match replays on demand so you never miss a moment. From the first serve to the final point, Roland Garros promises unforgettable moments and new chapters in tennis history. Stream now with Tennis Channel Plus to be there when it happens.